Blog Talk Radio.
Red light.
that I must be dreaming. Can't be real. You're not here with me. See what I can feel you did to me. Yeah. High chorus, you let you taste the just so blissful. Listen, I would give you anything, baby. Just to make my dream come true. Oh, baby, give me butterflies. I could be with you.
Uh-oh, you know what that means. Yep, you guessed it. It's a drip to mic day. The author Hesian got his love going up on a Tuesday like it's a Friday. Two literary prodigies, these scholars be so talented, they can write a novel about water and still entertain a nice tray. No filters tonight, they might say bright day-inducing diatribes that could make a life change. And if you ain't gang and don't hang with the Office Lounge on Tuesday, you might want to rearrange how you prioritize things. This is family, man. The Author's Lounge maintains by overstanding what's understood, so the unnecessary doesn't have to be explained. The pilot and co-pilot flying this plane entertains by unleashing verbal positive cargo as if it's carried by a train nonstop through your earlobes all the way in until it reaches the creative portion of your brain. Drip the mic is going to the top, high like we just copped a whole pound of the best strain, conducting top interviews and use our platform to help those who choose to network and idea exchange. This is 2 hours of insane vibes. The Archer's Lounge goes live every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Central and 7 p.m. Eastern. Guess what? We can be heard worldwide. You know, I sit back like watching Hezzy quarterback like he come with the content and the God is love catches the ball like running it up the side. Drip the Mic presents the Author's Lounge. Stick around so we can drop that sound that up until inception, you and others have been denied. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's hear those hands collide, and please help myself and the Drip the Mic Network welcome the Author's Lounge with your host, the author Hezzy, and co-host, God is Love in the building. Let's get it.
How you doing, everybody? And welcome to the Author's Lounge. My name is Author Hezzy, and my co-host, Miss Mona, are you in the building? Well, I guess I'll just carry on. Call in number 646-378-0355. Press 1 to speak. Tonight we have a great show for you all. And I am so proud to present this man right here. He's a member of the Order of Canada, the highest honor given by the Canadian government. And he's past president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. He's also the ABC TV series Flash Forward was based on his novel of the same name as one of only 8 writers in history to have won all 3 of the science fiction field's top awards for the best novel of the year. The Hugo, the Nebula, and a John W. Campbell Memorial Award. I want to introduce to the mic Mr. Robert Sawyer. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you? Nice to be here.
I'm great. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. I'm up here in Toronto where it's we're going to get the Snowmageddon tonight. It's just started, and it's going to continue for 2 days, apparently, but that's not atypical for us at this time of year. So except for the weather, I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, man, I want to apologize for last night.
We had a technical difficulty, I understand. No problem at all. I'm glad to be here today.
But it's okay, because I have a lot of questions for you tonight.
All right, let's get to it.
All right. But first of all, I want you to introduce yourself to the audience and let them know what you do and how you do it.
Sure. You did a lovely job with the intro. Thank you for the very kind words. I am a science fiction writer. A science fiction writer up here in Toronto, Canada. My website, because I'm a science fiction writer and I was good at predicting the future, I thought big. So I was able to secure the address for my website, SF Writer, SF as in science fiction, sfwriter.com. So if you want to know more about Robert J. Sawyer, head over to sfwriter.com after you've listened to this lovely show and check me out. I've got 25 novels under my belt. The one that's most recently in stores is called The Oppenheimer Alternative. It's a hard science fiction alternate history novel about the Manhattan Project physicists trying to stay together after the end of the war to save the world from impending destruction. And I hope people check that out, The Oppenheimer Alternative by Robert J. Sawyer.
Wow. So tell us about this highest honor of Canada. How in the world did you get that?
Well, you know, anybody who's a Canadian can nominate fellow Canadians for consideration for this honor. It's given by the Governor General. The Governor General, you know, we're in Canada here. We're still a monarchy. The Queen, you call her probably the Queen of England. We call her the Queen of Canada. That's her official title in this country, Elizabeth II. And her official representative in Canada is the Governor General. Well, the Governor General's office receives nominations from the public. I knew nothing about this when I was nominated, apparently by several people. And they have a very rigorous review process where they, you know, anybody can say, hey, my best bud is, you know, a superhero, make him a member of the Order of Canada. Doesn't quite work that way. They do due diligence and investigation. And I was absolutely thrilled, not only, of course, to be named to the Order of Canada, which, as you mentioned, is the highest highest honor given by the Canadian government, but to be the first person ever to be inducted into the Order of Canada specifically for work in the science fiction field. And I'll tell you, my friend, who the second person was. Can you guess?
I'm trying to.
William Shatner, Captain Kirk himself. He was number two. But I was number one, so that means the world to me. It means the world to me. And thank you for mentioning that honor. It's I have a big fancy medal that I'm only supposed to wear at state dinners and so forth, so I never get to put it on. I'm going to put that puppy on.
Honor right there. You know what I mean? And
yeah, the closest American equivalent is the Presidential Medal of Honor. It's at that level. I'm just, you know, so honored and thrilled to have it. And as a science fiction writer, you know, we authors, as a general law, we authors aren't necessarily accorded the respect that perhaps we should be given by society. But science fiction authors in particular, we've endured an awful lot of really mindless dismissal by people who have never even read the stuff. And so to have this conferred upon me, I consider not just a victory for me, but a victory for science fiction.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. So tell me a little bit about your newest book that you got out, The Oppenheimer.
The Oppenheimer Alternative. J. Robert Oppenheimer was the scientific head of the Manhattan Project, which was the secret U.S., Canada, Great Britain, three countries involved in it, project to develop the world's first atomic bomb. Obviously, wow. They succeeded. They succeeded in 1945. And I say they succeeded, but that's not 100% true, because their actual goal was to get an atomic bomb built in time to defeat Adolf Hitler and put an end to the war in Europe. Well, Hitler did what all these scientists and engineers failed to do in time. He put an end to the war in Europe by what? By putting a bullet through his own head. He committed suicide in April of 1945, and the atomic bomb wasn't ready yet. So rather than disband the project, although a bunch of the scientists involved said, you know, we missed the boat. The whole point of this was Hitler, and he's gone now. So why unleash this terrible, terrible weapon on the world? But they pushed ahead, mostly because the military wanted them to push ahead. And 4 months later, 3.5 months later, in August of 1945, of course, they succeeded. And on August 6th, the first atomic bomb ever used was in battle was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the second one on the Japanese city of Nagasaki. And shortly after that, the Emperor Hirohito surrendered, and the war in the Pacific, the final phase of the Second World War, came to an end. Well, that's what happened in history, and certainly some of that is recounted in my novel. But what I go, instead of, you know, so the dates are significant. August 9th is when they dropped the second bomb, and shortly thereafter, as I say, Hirohito surrenders. On radio, the first time that most Japanese had ever heard his voice, by the way, unlike, you know, our politicians today who are on radio, TV, and everywhere all the time, the emperor was considered divine, and it was beneath his dignity, you know, to actually speak to the people. But he spoke and said, we're defeated. We're done. We got to throw in the towel here and accept whatever terms the Allies imposed upon us. But anyways, we're at the beginning of August. Well, what happens the next month? School goes back. Who are these people who built the bombs? University professors. They all were ready to scatter to the four winds and take whatever academic posts they could get, especially now that they were world famous for having ended the war. But I contrive in my novel, this is what makes it an alternate history, that instead of disbanding at the end of World War II, this brain trust, the greatest physicists in history, including at the top of the chain, of course, Albert Einstein and others like Enrico Fermi and Edward Teller, Oppenheimer himself, I.I. Rabi, they all stay together to save the world from another threat, which is the trick of my novel, that there's an impending other threat to the whole planet that only this brilliant brain trust can save. That's the Oppenheimer alternative by me, Rob Sawyer.
Wow. Awesome. That is amazing, because I've always been interested in, like, I like studying history a lot. And, you know, they say history repeats itself. And as of now, everybody's racing to have the biggest weapon they can. For, like, what reason? You know, it's like Russia, like the Cuban affair, when Russia and the U.S. was coming head to head with these submarines and was about to blast each other with these nuclear bombs.
Absolutely. The Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy versus Khrushchev, toe-to-toe, and it really, you know, I was just a kid when that happened, like a very young kid, a toddler. But people, my older brother, my parents, people who were alive when that happened, my God, they thought that, you know, it was secret originally, but once it came out, how close did it come? We came so close to World War III. And, Albert Einstein, again, associated with, one little quipper, Einstein said, you know, the Third World War will be thought, I don't know what the Third World War will be fought with. He thought probably atomic weapons. But I'll tell you what the Fourth will be fought with, sticks and stones, because we'll be bombed back into the Stone Age.
That's right. Yeah. And if it wasn't for JFK, at least talk them out of it. It was done. It was over with.
It really was. That's right. And it was, you know, this what I love that came out of it, I've got to say, is the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union sort of came out of that Cuban Missile Crisis, because instead of going head to head in a way that might kill everybody. Suddenly, the big race, the big battle was for something positive instead of something negative, putting, as Kennedy said in 1961, put a man on the moon and return him safely to the earth by the end of this decade. I didn't get the quote quite right, nor the invitation, but you get the drift, right? That suddenly the United States and the Soviet Union, the best and brightest young men, science and women, young men and women scientists of the early 60s, instead of working on the nuclear effort, they had something positive to work on for a change, the space race.
Yeah. And now it's like everything is still is coming back ahead now. You know what I mean? Like China, they said they have something that's going out of space now that they could send a bomb across. And then Russia and Ukraine. I'm like, okay, what is Ukraine's natural resource? Why do they even want to take over Ukraine? That's to take over there? What is Ukraine's natural resource? Why Russia wants them so bad? And it's
that's
all about
because, I mean, exactly, exactly. Russia itself is a huge petroleum giant. They don't need Ukraine. But
right.
And, you know, the hallmark of everything since the end of World War II, World War II, as you may recall, started with Hitler invading Poland and taking, mm-hmm. annexing other territories. We don't do that anymore. Since World War II, the democratic countries of the world have said our borders are the borders. We don't quibble of them anymore. Canada and the United States, we have the longest undefended border in the world, and we both sleep easily at night, Americans and Canadians, without fearing that we're going to be annexed or taken over or whatever, invaded. Nobody worries about that, except apparently Vladimir Putin, who wants to invade his neighboring country. Just who knows why? You ask a very good question. Who knows why, except that he wants to flex his muscle.
Yeah, and he figures they have more of a Western influence in Ukraine, and he hates that.
Right, that's right. We had a triumph, they called the 20th century the American century. Historians often use that phrase. And in a lot of senses, it really is true that American ideals of liberal, I use that in terms of liberty, right, freedom and so forth, liberal democracy and capitalism took over, really, the developed world in the 20th century, and it really was the American worldview that became dominant. And, of course, the Soviet Union fell by the end of the 20th century. But Vladimir Putin remembers those old days when they were the number two world power, the Soviet Union. And I think he kind of wishes that they could be the number two or the number one again instead of this broken, desolate economy that they have now.
And you know what's funny? You know, China's been back because they're trying to push their values on the European countries. And the Europeans caught on during the coronavirus. They like, no, we don't want what China has to offer no more. Australia doesn't want them, and it's all
fear. Yeah, that's exactly right. We're, the coronavirus is a common enemy of humanity. And we used to, there's an old science fiction trope. There was a great episode of the Outer Limits TV series that explored this, the original black and white version. But it was often said in science fiction, you know what's really needed? Is some threat against the whole human race, that if alien invaders were to come, we would, you know, it wouldn't matter, Chinese, Soviet or Russian, American, African, everybody all over the planet would unite to the and recognize the common brotherhood and sisterhood of all of us. Instead, it turns out when we get coronavirus that there are enough people who aren't going to join in the fight with the rest of us so that we actually are, coronavirus may ultimately win. Omicron is in retreat right now, which is great, but there are a lot more letters left in the Greek alphabet, I got to say, after Omicron.
The best part about this show is, I like to talk about your books, but I'd rather the audience get to know the author.
Absolutely.
Because we talk about our books 24/7, 7 days a week.
Oh,
we
yeah.
get scripted
and I'd rather people, they've got the teaser now for the book. if the Oppenheimer interests, the Oppenheimer alternative interests them, it's everywhere that they might want to get it, bookstores, Amazon, Audible, ebook versions. But let's talk about me. How can I say no?
Hey, that's what it's all about. It's all about the author. That's why we call it the author's lounge. So you can come in and chill and talk about you. So about this ABC TV series, I think my co-host is on the line now too. I would like for you to meet her if she's still here.
Oh,
I'm
lovely.
Here.
Yes, please. Hello.
This is Miss
Hi.
Mona.
How
Hello,
are
welcome.
You?
I'm
welcome.
Fine. Hello
no, welcome
from,
to you.
Canada.
Oh,
delighted to be here. Thank you.
Oh, you're from Canada.
From Toronto, yes.
Oh, that's awesome. I have family in Canada, but they're from Montreal.
Montreal is such a beautiful, beautiful city. I'm sure they just love it there.
It is. It is. It is. I've been there a few times.
Yes, it's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me, both of you.
Yes, this is my beautiful co-host.
I'm so sorry. I'm running I was a few minutes late.
That's okay. You know what? We science fiction guys, I'm a science fiction writer, are always running a few minutes ahead of time anyways into the future. So,
Right.
At some point in time, it all comes together. It's no problem. It's glad to be here.
Right. Okay, so can I ask a quick question?
Of course, yeah.
So science fiction, is that the only genre that you write in?
Yes. Well, you know, the reason, yes and no. I'm going to say yes, because every book that I've published, and I've written 25 now, it's a science fiction novel. But many of them are science fiction and something else. So, for instance, but the novel that most currently is the Oppenheimer Alternative is science fiction and history. I've had novels that are science fiction and courtroom drama. There's one called The Legal Alien that I did. Science fiction and romance. There's one called Rollback that I did that fit that mold. And science fiction and adventure. There's one called Farseer I did. I love science fiction because its canvas is all of space, all of time, and all forms of life. And in that canvas, you can tell any kind of story in addition to it being a science fiction tale. So I love that aspect of it. But yes, I'm commercially known as a science fiction writer. And as I said earlier before you came on, my website is actually called sfwriter.com. S as in science, F as in fiction, writer.com.
Right.
You know,
oh,
and
wow.
I sometimes, that said, you know, I mean, I'm an artist at heart. Every artist likes to try different things, and I certainly have contemplated doing what's commonly referred to as a mainstream novel, a novel that, you know, is just contemporary in setting. A lot of my science fiction is set in the present day, but with no technological or scientific element to it. The problem is that, you know, I have an audience. You become kind of a brand as an author, and my audience expects that broad category of science fiction from me, and anything else I did would confuse them. So I think I have to adopt a pen name if I ever write a mainstream novel. And I actually have that pen name. I'll tell you what it is so that if I ever see this name in the future, you can look for it. It's Eric Covert. And the reason that sounds is a great name from my point of view, and your relatives in Montreal, if they happen to be listening tonight, they will get it, because Eric Covert is French for green bean, and bean was my nickname when I was growing up, from soya bean, my last name, Sawyer, soya bean. So Eric Covert is Eric Covert, the green bean.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
Never used that name yet, but I've been thinking about it. I have another one to fall back on if I ever need to as well, because my writing name, my legal name and my writing name, it's not a pen name, is Robert J. Sawyer. And an anagram of that is Joe Strawberry. So if you ever see a book by Joe Strawberry, that's also me trying to write in a different genre. Eric Covert, Joe Strawberry, they're all Robert J. Sawyer.
You know, I was thinking about using the pen name, too.
Oh, yeah.
But mine was for a different reason. Hey, I was thinking about using a pen name, too, but mine was for a different reason. I don't need my daughter's mother contracting me. Hey, I need more money. So we're not going to get into that.
Well, you know, this is an interesting question, right? Because there are people say to me, you know, they said, author, is that your real name, right? Because they're used to this concept of a pen name. And one of the reasons, you know, that I wanted to use my real name is I wanted the people who did not support me or believe in me in particularly in junior high and earlier, some of those bullies and so forth, to have it show up in their face periodically that I made a success of myself. But the flip side, I can well understand, there are people who like their anonymity a great deal and go to great lengths to protect that. One of my colleagues, a very fine science fiction writer named the pen name he uses is Greg Egan, E-G-A-N, one of the best hard science fiction writers about artificial intelligence. But he is a non-entity. If you search for him online, you won't find his real name or where he is in Australia, but where he works or exactly what he does, except that he's a very, very fine writer. People have their reasons, and often we don't know what those reasons are. I've been reading a little Jane Austen, speaking of authors. I'm reading Pride and Prejudice. And intriguingly, she didn't want her books published in her lifetime under her own name. Now it's one of the most famous names in certainly English literature, Jane Austen, but she didn't want to be known. She wanted it, you know, didn't mind them being published, but didn't want anybody to know who she was.
Wow.
So.
There it is.
Let's fast forward a little bit. I want to talk about this ABC TV series.
Yes. Flash Forward was the name of it. Mm-hmm. Based on my novel of the same name, which is still in print and also in Audible and ebook and so forth, Flash Forward by Robert J. Sawyer. It was on ABC starting in 2009. We had one really wonderful season. We ran 22 episodes. Starring Joseph Fiennes and John Cho. We were lucky. We had signed John Cho for the show just before Star Trek 2009 was in theaters. John played Sulu, of course, in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. And although he'd been in Harold and Kumar and things before that, he really took off as a big bankable name. After we had signed him, the summer before we debuted, he happened to be in the theaters with the Star Trek 2009. Dominic Monaghan, who everybody knows from the Lord of the Rings movies, he was in our series as well. Just a wonderful experience. For me, the biggest thrill, besides, you know, the paychecks, which were very nice, was getting to write one of the episodes myself. That was an absolute blast.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when you sit down and negotiate these contracts, no, I didn't do it. My manager did it. But you say, what are the things you want, you know? And, of course, everybody says, well, money, I want this, I want that. I said, I want to write. I don't want it to be one of these, or write for the show. I don't want to be one of these circumstances where they take the property away and you never hear from them again. I want to be involved. I want to be one of the writers. And fortunately, the guys who were the showrunners of the series, initially David Goyer and Brandon Braga, were both fans of my work, and they didn't put up a fight about that. They were very, very supportive of me being on board and writing for the show.
Awesome. Because, you know, it's also, when you're doing your own show, you want it to be authentic as you possibly can.
Well, there's truth in that, but I also, they did a fairly liberal adaptation of my novel. And I said to David Goyer in the writer's room for the show, Dave, I will never say to you, but that's not the way it was in my book. But I'll be all over your ass if you do something in episode 8 that contradicts what you did in episode 2.
Yes.
And on that basis, we got along fabulously. Because you have to understand, when somebody else is the showrunner, that title is the head writer of a series, if people don't know what that title means. They're the executive producer who's also the head writer, who makes the decisions about everybody's stories. There may be multiple, right? We had a dozen different writers on Flash Forward, but it's the head writer, the showrunner, who decides what gets in and what gets out, and, you know, which arcs the characters go through and so forth. So Dave was our show, terrific guy. He's now on the Apple TV adaptation of Isaac Asimov's Foundation series,
wow.
Foundation science fiction novels. He's the showrunner for that. And he wrote Batman Begins, that wonderful movie, of course. And many his credits are inestimable. I mean, just a fabulous guy. I love him, Dave Goyer. But he was in charge. I was not. Once I'd signed that check, Dave was the boss, and it was his vision of the central idea that, granted, was mine, but his vision that we were going to put up on the screen. And that's what everybody who worked on that show did.
Awesome. Awesome. Wow.
You know, you do get adaptations that are very faithful. I just happened this past weekend to finally get around to seeing the new Denis Villeneuve. There's another Montreal connection, the director Denis Villeneuve, his adaptation of Frank Herbert's novel Dune, which, of course, is a giant blockbuster hit. Starring Timothy Chalamet and many other very fine, Oscar Isaac, many fine actors in that. And that's a very faithful adaptation. Purists, of course, will quibble. This was changed. That part was dropped. But by and large, it is extremely close to the source material. And that's wonderful if it can happen. But the vast majority of when you see based on a novel by it's a liberal adaptation. And I went in with my eyes wide open, I'll tell you about this, because three of my favorite movies are very liberal adaptations of novels. I love, we talked earlier at the beginning of the show about the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War satiric comedy, Dr. Strangelove, is based on a very serious novel, absolutely devoid of satire or comedy, called Red Alert by an author named Peter George, and doesn't even have the character of Dr. Strangelove in it. Casablanca, everybody loves the movie Casablanca. Did you know it's based on a stage play? The stage play is called Everybody Comes to Rick's. It's a terrible play. Nobody ever, you know, you could mount it. You could get a license and put it on at your local high school or your local community theater, but nobody ever does because it's an awful
just like
play.
Denzel Washington just remade The Tragedy of Macbeth in school. I hated to read that in school. That sucked.
But now... Right? Yeah. As you know, you go and see some of the adaptations that are out now, the current adaptation, and you're blown away, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And the third one, just to finish it off here, is Planet of the Apes. I'm a huge fan of the original Planet of the Apes, original five films, and they're based on a French novel, Le Planet des Singes, which is French for The Planet of Apes, by Pierre Boulle.
Did you actually watch it on TV?
I've seen them on TV. I see them in the theater.
Oh, my God.
I got them on Blu-ray. I'm waiting for the 4K, man.
I'm 43 years old, too. I'm 43 years old, too. So I used to have to watch.
I'm 61, my friend.
Oh, my God. But, can I watch this? But then when they made the remake of it, it was like, yeah.
Well, here we have a little bit of a disagreement, my friend. I like the original better than the remake. But the point being, just to wrap up this little thread here, is that the novel they're based on, a very good novel, completely different than the original Charlton Heston film or anything that came later. Pierre Boulle, I'll just mention in passing, is best known, certainly as creator of Planet of the Apes, but also as the author of Bridge on the River Kwai, which also became a very famous movie adaptation starring Alec Guinness long before he was Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Because, like, me growing up, we had He-Man. Oh, when they made that into a movie, that was the best movie I ever seen, He-Man.
I love
that movie.
You know, I think most of us who love any particular book have trepidation when somebody mm-hmm. says, oh, it's going to become a movie. We're always, you know, oh, well, great, unless they blow it, right? If they do a great job, we're thrilled. If it sucks, then we're kind of hugely disappointed, especially because if there's a bad version made, they're probably never going to make another one.
Well, let me name the movies that Tom Hanks was playing in. I forgot to – Dan Brown, The Angels and Demons? And
oh, yeah, absolutely. The first Da Vinci Code.
They blew the movies. The first one was good. It was right on point, almost.
Yeah, it was a very close adaptation.
They went so far away from the adaptation for the rest of the movies. I was totally disappointed because they were so – in his books, he is so in-depth. He gives you the history and all of this and the artifacts that you see in the book that you can just visualize. When they the movie, you was like, where they at?
Yeah, I agree with you. As an author, I would say technically, Dan Brown is not a very sophisticated writer, but as a rip-roaring storyteller, I could not put down, like millions around the world, I could not put down The Da Vinci Code. And
my favorite book. It's one of my favorites. I can't say it's my favorite because I love
very
books.
Good.
But The Da Vinci
very
Code,
good.
I was stuck on it.
Yeah, I read Da Vinci Code. I read Angels and Demons. I tried to read The Lost Symbol, and that one didn't work for me. Which is also, more power to him, right? Dan Brown, he did two things that you can't ever take away from him. One is that he sold a huge number of books, but number two, and this is why all authors have to love him and have to love, J.K. Rowling and other people, whether they agree with their politics or not. They got people who hadn't read a book ever in the case of J.K. Rowling in terms of a lot of young people or for years in the case of Dan Brown for his adult readers to get back into reading books. And you've got every author on the planet owes them a vote of thanks for making reading an exciting thing to do again.
And I think that's why I enjoy writing so much, because I'm trying to get people to read. And they always ask me, well, do you want to do audio book? And I said, no, I want paperback. I want people to read. I want them to physically read the book.
Yes. No, you raise an excellent point. Now, you've got a fabulous voice. I mean, if you ever did want to do the audio book, you would do a wonderful, wonderful job of it. But
thank you.
You're so welcome. I do listen to audio books in the car and so forth. I mean, rather than no intake of material, almost all the audio books I listen to are nonfiction. As a fiction writer, I love reading a novel, the printed word, because I don't just want to hear what the author had to say. I want to see how they said it. It only maybe means something to fellow authors, you and me and, so forth. But we like to see how do they wield a comma? Where do they put the break in a paragraph? What's their layout on a page? Is it a dense page? Is it a loose page? All of that
You know what's so funny? Like, my first book, it was basically an autobiography. So I was like, okay, this is my first book. Then my second book was another one of my autobiographies. But then when I started writing and really create, I started studying the different authors. Well, how do they make a story?
Yeah.
How do you conduct a story? How do you keep your characters relevant in the story? And I studied John Grisham. I studied Dan Brown. I studied Erzsébet Dickey, different kind of authors on how do you make a romantic scene? How do you do a romance scene? How do you do different scenes? How do you do action scenes? And it's all about putting it all together and creating a story to fit your personality. But you have to study all the authors. If not, you don't get no authenticity. You don't get no – it's not a passion if you're just writing, because you're writing to create – it's almost like an art form.
And 100% agree with you.
And the authors that came before us, they're teaching us, how can I take from you? What can I learn from you? How can I construct my book this way, to be similar to yours, but not just like yours, but how I want my characters to fit. And that's what I do. I study different authors. I'm reading The Street Lawyer by Don Grissom.
You know, you're absolutely right. I don't do it much anymore, but I used to teach writing. And the question I'd ask, very first class, first question I'd ask the students, what are you currently reading? And mm-hmm. what was astonishing to me is that people would come to a creative writing class and not currently or even recently having read anything, fiction or nonfiction.
No.
It's insane, right?
Yes.
A photographer is always looking at the work of other photographers. A musician is always listening to the best of contemporary and classical music. A painter is always visiting museums to see how the masters did it. But so many people think they can write without ever immersing themselves in what others have written. And it's a sure sign that they're not going to make it. If they're not readers first, I don't think they're ever going to be writers.
Yep, you're right. You're definitely right. They're not, because you're not studying. You have to study. Like
That's right.
I'm glad to hear
you mention the authors that you read for yourself because, you know, people ask me, what's a good how to write book? And mm-hmm. I say, Moby Dick is a good how-to-write book, right? Farewell to Arms is a good how-to-write book. To Kill mm-hmm. a Mockingbird is a good how-to-write book. Take mm-hmm. a great book by a great author and just really read it carefully. Don't skim it. Don't breeze through it. And if after you finished it, go back and say, oh, okay, here's where the seed is planted for that thing that bears fruit 40 chapters later, right? You know, study the great works. That's how you learn how to do it.
Exactly. You're right on point there, my friend.
Thank you. And, you know, I mean, as I mentioned, I'm a science fiction writer. I've got on my wall right here in my home, I've got a picture of H.G. Wells on the wall because, you know, who wrote The War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, three of the most famous science fiction works of all time. And I always ask myself, you know, I mean, there wasn't even a name science fiction when he was writing science fiction. He was doing his best work in the 1890s. Just remind myself of, you know, there's the benchmark, right? How would old Herbert George Wells mm-hmm. have handled this?
And you know what's so funny? I was in a driveway, and I decided to read a John Grissom book. And it was about this lawyer. He was an old alcoholic. And the family had left him a whole lot of money. Well, the dad decides to act like he's crazy. He jumps out the window and commits suicide. So the family thinks they're getting a whole lot of money. Well, he decides they have to go through these different things to get the trust.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny because he had a long estranged daughter through an affair. And this old drunken lawyer had to go find him. And I was like, it was a perfect story and perfect setup. I was like, you know what? When I write my next book, I need to set it up like this, because it was a perfect storyline.
I'm a big fan of John Grisham. I think, sometimes the literary establishment will poo-poo the writers who are enormous financial successes like mm-hmm. John Grisham or say, Stephen King. But in fact, those guys become those huge successes in most mm-hmm. cases because they are masterfully good writers. The thing I mm-hmm. like about Grisham most of all is he's not afraid to tackle really big themes in his
yes.
books. You take a book like
yes.
The Chamber. The Chamber is about the death penalty. And mm-hmm. he wanted to write a novel about, not about what he considers to be how immoral execution of people by the state is, and that's, you know, certainly yes. happens to be my own opinion as well, but he didn't take the easy way. The easy way is to write most of his books are about lawyers, to write a lawyer who manages to get a innocent defendant saved just before he's about to be in the electric chair or in the gas chamber. That's the easy story. The hard
yes.
story is to take, as he did, an unrepentant murderer who says, if you let me out, I would do this again. I don't feel any remorse. I'm happy I did it. Yeah, 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 yeah. And put the lawyer up there who still has to plead for leniency for this guy not to be executed, because the moral issue of, we can't say in Grisham's opinion, as a state, as a society, if we're going to say that killing is evil, then the state should not kill. That's a big, now you can agree or disagree, that's fine. In fact, that's what makes talking about books wonderful, right? You finish reading and say, well, I think Grisham is full of crap, or yeah, Grisham is exactly right, and you get a debate, discussion with your friend. Another one of his like that is The Runaway Jury, which is, if you recall that, the movie version was done a bit differently.
Yes,
the film version.
You made that book too.
The film, right? It's about the culpability of tobacco companies, of big tobacco, for the enormous amount of lung cancer that they've caused in people. And that's a big issue to take.
Like
on,
the one
right?
I read,
and,
the one I read now is called A Street Lawyer. It's this big-time lawyer. He's, and some homeless guy comes into his building and plans to shoot up the building. Well, he has this epiphany. And the big-time corporations have pushed these homeless people out of their buildings where they used to live, and they're dying all over, while these big corporations are getting rich, but the homeless people, the poor people have nowhere to stay and stuff. So he quits his job at the big-time law firm, loses his wife because he's not making $100 million anymore, and he goes to take his job as a street lawyer to help the homeless and everything. So I'm only halfway through it. But it's issues that's going on that John Grisham tackled.
That's right. And see, my own field of science fiction gets dismissed, again, by those who never read it, as being, you know, escapist, right? But it's the farthest thing. I mean, the books that survive, that people read, not just, you know, in the year they come out, but decades or even centuries after they come out, are about something. They've got something to say. They've got meat on their bones to chew on. And, you know, they're not just a simple plot. You look at the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code is about the nature of Jesus Christ, the character of Jesus Christ. Did Jesus Christ, in fact, have a worldly existence that included the pleasures of the flesh with Mary Magdalene?
And
did he, in fact, give birth to a bloodline? And what, you know, because that's a huge issue to talk about. And we talk about the failure of Christianity in the sort of the world right now. It says, well, nobody can be Christ-like, right? Well, Christian says, well, maybe Christ wasn't quite perfect, but, you know, let's take Christ down a notch and make him a little more human, and then listen maybe a little more closely to the positive things that he's reputed to have said. Now, again, you can be a Christian, you can be an atheist. I happen to be an atheist. Read that book and found, this is powerful. He was talking about really big stuff in this incredible page-turner mystery about a murder at the Louvre in Paris. I mean, it up in the most appealing package possible, but at its core, it's a novel about what was Jesus Christ really like, if he really existed.
Yes.
Powerful.
It was. We could talk all night long, but we're running out of time.
I think one of my friends coming on in the next hour, though. You've got another guest tonight, I do believe.
Oh, man, it was great. So can you tell us where to find your books and platforms that we can get your books on? And, man, I definitely got to get one of your books, but I'm definitely a big history.
Thank
history
you. Fan. Well, my name again is Robert Sawyer, Robert J. Sawyer, and my books are everywhere. I mean, they're available in e-books on every platform. They're available in print books and bookstores. They're available, obviously, through Amazon and Barnes & Noble, their websites, and anybody else that sells books. My most recent one, also Audible or other audiobook vendors have all of my books, including my most recent one, are available as audiobooks as well. So take your choice of platform. My most recent one is The Oppenheimer Alternative, a hard science fiction alternate history novel about the physicists of the Manhattan Project. And my website, sfwriter.com, S as in science, F as in fiction, writer.com. And again, I'm Robert J. Sawyer.
Oh, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
What a pleasure. Anytime. My honor, absolutely. You guys stay well.
All right. You have a great night.
I will. Take care.
Bye. Yes, you do. Thank you.
I want to thank y'all for tuning into the Author's Lounge. Call in 346-378-0355. Press 1 to speak. We're going to take a quick break. And up next, we got author Mr. Freddie Cruz and Who Counseled the DJ.
Boom. Boy.
Welcome back to the Office Lounge, presented to you by Drip the Mic. Call in 646-378-0355. I'm your host, Arthur Hezzy, and my co-host is Miss Mona. Are you ready for the second guest? Well, I guess I'm by myself again. Well, let's bring in Mr. Arthur Freddie Cruz.
Why, hello. Hello, hello. Hey. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Yes. How are you?
Good. I said today. I meant tonight, this evening. But it's daytime somewhere. So. Good morning,
you.
Good afternoon, good evening, everybody.
Yes, yes. So, your book,
the DJ. Tell us about your book.
Yeah, well, They Canceled the DJ follows the inspired by actual event story of a disc jockey who breaks the cardinal sin. For listeners out there who don't know the cardinal sin of radio, you never date a listener. There's more than one reason why you never date a listener if you are a radio personality, but AC breaks this rule and dates a listener. What happens to him is he gets dumped in the middle of a concert while his girlfriend is on stage getting serenaded by the world's most famous pop star, the fictitious character, River Bronzewell. Chaos ensues afterward, and as an author, my job is to make his life a living nightmare, and that's what I did. So there you go.
So what gave you the idea to write the book? What happened to the dude?
Well, you know, I got a bad review for the first novel that I wrote, which I kind of wear as a badge of honor, but I was sulking in misery for a weekend and read the book Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss, and I refer to the book quite often because there's
so
many great interviews. Hey,
hi,
welcome to the party.
I'm sorry. I'm Mona, the co-host. How are you?
Hey, Mona. Good, good. It's a party now.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so I was reading an interview with Jon Favreau, one of my favorite screenwriters, producers. He's in movies. And so it was basically one of those things where he's like, write what you know. And so I go, yeah, you know what? I should write what I know. What am I? I'm a radio personality. I'm a producer. I do all these things. I should write my next novel instead of trying to write a sequel to this first book. What I'm going to do is write a novel based on a radio DJ. And that was about the extent of it. So I pulled out the pen and pad and just started writing away. And one of my buddies got kind of dumped by somebody he thought was interested in him at a music festival. This was all pre-pandemic. So this was Austin City Limits. So he was backstage with a band that shall remain nameless and a photographer from another publication, he being a radio DJ, thought that they were hitting it off. And then lo and behold, she runs off with the musician. Turns out they're married and they live in Europe. And so,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So hearing that story, hearing him recall that story, I'm like, okay, there's something there. And so I just basically took that inspiration. That's why I say it's inspired by actual events, not based on a true story, just inspired by. So I took that, and then as the baseline, okay, this dude's gonna get embarrassed, but instead of in a backstage area, on a large scale, on a grand scale, okay, we're talking a stadium tour in front of thousands of listeners with their smartphones on, because you know, you don't ever go to a concert. You don't go to a concert and not have your smartphone on. So it's not just in front of tens of thousands of screaming fans. It's before the internet, in front of the eyes of the internet. The eyes of the universe are on AC getting his heart decimated for River Bronzewell, the fictitious musician. So there you go.
Wow. Wow. So how many books have you written? Man, that sounds interesting.
Well, thank you. Two that are published, and I am sitting on a couple of manuscripts, one of which I hope to have out later on this year, and am kind of toying around with an idea of a spinoff in the same universe as novel When America Fell Silent. So there's no shortage of ideas when it comes to writing new books. Yeah. It's fun. You get to make up imaginary friends and enemies and destroy their worlds and make good things happen to the bad people, make bad things happen to the good people. Then at the very end, something happens and we see how everyone's changed It's just it's interesting. It's fun.
Wow, definitely. So, what gave you the inspiration to be an author?
Well, it was a Saturday night, and my family and I, and they were tweenagers at the time, my daughters and I and my wife, we were at Barnes & Noble. It was a crazy Saturday night at Barnes & Noble. And they're like, Dad, you should write a book. And I turn to them, I go, really? Yeah, you like to read a lot. Why don't you write one? I go, huh, yeah, maybe I should. So that got the wheels turning, and then I started over the next few weeks conceptualizing what I would want that book to be about. Mm-hmm. And so at the time I was very worried about censorship, and I think it still kind of is an issue. I think it'll always be. It's just kind of like the eternal question, when are we going to finally get silenced for good? I mean, this is like something that has been going on for centuries and centuries and centuries. And I think modern Americans would be arrogant to think that it's unique to us. I was just concerned. And so I go, wow, well, what if we actually lived under a completely totalitarian government that not only just repealed the First Amendment, but also, you know, sent its citizens out to spy on each other, like the KGB, like Soviet Russia, like some of these Eastern European blocs, and utilizing the apparatus that we have, because we have the most, you know, powerful government in the history of humanity. So what would that look like? Yeah, what would it look like with, you know, when we have these federal agencies that have armed SWAT units? What would that look like if we consolidated everything, consolidated all of this power? What would that look like? And so that was the basis for the story. Did a lot of research.
Like, we're headed towards that way.
Do what now?
It kind of feels like we're headed towards that way.
Yeah, well, you know, and what I didn't want to do was set it in present times, because I also didn't want – I wanted the theme, and this, of course, the first book, When America Fell Silent, I wanted it to be – because I think authoritarianism does not know a party. Authoritarianism is its own end. So I wanted to make sure that I was apolitical, not political. And I think that I accomplished that, because I had right wingers and left wingers telling me, like, I couldn't tell who you were writing about. I think the mission was accomplished, and the biggest compliment had to have come from one of my buddies who's an engineer who read the book. And of course, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm nowhere near as smart as anybody who's an engineer. So when an engineer tells me that he thought that the book reminded him of the Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who is the guy who was credited with the fall of the Soviet Empire, when he tells me that my book reminded him of that book, that was the ultimate compliment. Better than getting a New York Times 5-star review or whatever it is they hand out. Yeah, so that was that.
That is awesome. So growing up, did you ever think that you was going to be an author?
No, to be honest with you, I thought I was going to be like Bo Jackson.
Yeah, me and you both.
Look, dude, I was just having this conversation with a guy who I was interviewing from Sports Illustrated, who wrote a book about the 90s Knicks. And, you know, growing up and being a teenager, and I think it was my tween years that Bo Jackson was doing his thing. He had like the 300 plus batting average and was hitting 32 home runs.
And the best years ever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, such an incredible athlete. And, of course, I was an early bloomer. I don't know about you, but I was an early bloomer. So I was taller and bigger and faster than all of my friends.
I was a late bloomer.
Oh, okay.
Late. Like puberty ain't hit me to about like 10th grade.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, everyone passed me up, dude. I was bigger than everybody in sixth grade, and then all of a sudden I stopped growing. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to be like Bo anymore. So I thought, well, how can I still be in sports? Well, I can try and do television broadcasting. Well, how do you get into television broadcasting? Well, radio is a stepping stone. Well, how do you get on the radio? So I started studying radio in college and kind of just, you know, really dissecting how to get from point A to point B so I could still be affiliated with sports in some way, shape, or form. Ended up changing my major from radio, TV to marketing. Kids, if you're listening, do not major in communications. So I had that to fall back on. And I got into radio as a stepping stone to get into TV, and I just never left. I still make appearances on TV every now and then if I'm invited to do a segment or whatever. But I've made my career in broadcast radio for 26 years now. I'm on my own. I've left the corporate world of terrestrial radio, and I'm now doing a podcast that'll be launching soon. Yeah, so that's kind of – I never really knew I was going to be an author until my kids challenged me to it. But I've always written. I think that's the big deal. If we're dissecting my career and going back, it's I'd always written. I've always had fun writing. I wrote for the yearbook staff. I always did good in my business classes. I did okay in English. A lot of the required reading was kind of boring, but yeah, it's just one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Very
interesting. Co-host, you have anything to add?
I agree the yearbook was kind of boring. I was on the yearbook committee, too.
It's fun, right?
I guess. It depends on the school, I guess.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, you know, I think deadlines, because that's the one thing I learned early on was if you're going to be on the yearbook staff, you got deadlines. Of course, they're not nearly as tight as newspaper staff, but it instilled urgency with writing and being in radio.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. You go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I'm very bad with deadlines. I've always been bad with deadlines. You know, ever since like my high school days. So that's why when I became a published author and I signed with a publisher, meeting deadlines doesn't work for me at all.
So what kind of deadlines do you like? Do you like the, are you talking loose deadlines? It's like, okay, Mona, we need you to have this done in 6 months. Can you get 200 pages written within 6 months?
Oh no, 6 months I could work with that. I'm just a very slow writer. Like if you assign something for me to write and, you know, the deadline is 3 weeks, that's where the problem occurs.
That 29th week is when you're going to start.
Right.
Oh, man.
Sometimes something just doesn't form in my head. It takes a while to develop, so. But
I prefer performing under pressure.
Oh,
like, I never studied to the last minute, or like I'm
you're one of those people.
it's something humans
we do that to each other. It's the eternal struggle. It's
You know what? I'm kind of like that too. Like if something is due, like I won't start working on it until the last minute, really. You know, and that comes with studying for a test and stuff. I'll be cramming in the night before, you know, so I'm kind of like that.
Yeah. So you say you're a slow writer, Mona. Do you write, do you write 1,000 words a day when you're on a on a project, writing a manuscript for fiction or nonfiction? Is it 1,000 words a day, 500 words a day? Is it kind of like 1,000 words whenever I get to them, or how does it work out for you?
My words per day are not consistent.
I can relate.
It could be. It could be like 500 a day.
See, for me, I don't write every day. I have to get hit with the writing bug. And when I write, I don't stop until I'm done.
Okay, do you all write longhand or do you type?
I write longhand. I write. I think writing brains out when you're writing instead of typing, it brings out your imagination more, and it brings out your outlook and your way of thinking even more to me.
Yes. You're more part of the story or part of the project that you're writing, if it's nonfiction. You're more engaged to me. And especially when you're typing in the 21st century, I don't know how many people are actually using typewriters. I imagine not very many. But so you're looking at a screen, and it's a big, intimidating, blank, bright, white screen. And if you have writer's block, that'll get inside your head. And then you develop imposter syndrome. And that, I don't know about the two of you, but it's really hard to get over. Sometimes I'm thinking to myself, okay, who the heck do you think you are? Like, who do you think you are? Why do you think you have it in you to do this? You're not a writer. And, you know, and then I'm like, yeah, I'm not a writer. And then I'll go and walk the dog. And then I'll kind of engage in negative self-talk. And then I'll come back and like, you know what? You are a writer. Sit your butt down in the chair and just start cranking the words out.
Yeah.
And that's how you overcome.
That's why I do not use a computer or nothing when I write. I write it all on paper first.
See?
Then
yeah.
I transfer it over.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and not only that, it's like when you're transcribing your words, excuse me, when you're transcribing your words, it's like you're editing as you're writing, so you've got a second draft. So that's your second draft already, or like a half draft. And then you can print it out, and then you write I love this part where you print out your manuscript. And it's only one-sided, so that way you have it. You take it to the Office Max or Office Depot. You have it print. You have it bound together, and then you can write in your with the wide margins, and then you have it printed on one side, right? So that on the left side you can write in and draw lines, and it's like a football coach drawing plays when you write in all your edits, and then you go in and transcribe the edits. A lot of fun. I think it keeps you more engaged when you're writing longhand. Of course, your handwriting can't be too sloppy. Mine is chicken scratch. Sometimes I don't know what I'm writing. Or do y'all ever, when you're writing longhand, do you ever fall asleep writing? And then you're like, what the heck did I do last night?
Not to do that. I try not to do that. I definitely try not to do that. That's why I use pencil and pad.
Yeah, there you go, man. There you go. Yeah. Oh, man. The life of a writer, baby. Did I lose you?
You gotta love it. You gotta love it.
Yeah.
Yes. But man, it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, when you think about it, and you look at your work, and you're holding it in your hand, whether it's an actual physical book with pages that you turn, or if you're holding your gadget and you're looking at an ebook version, it's like that came out of my head, and I did this and created this with my hands, writing these things that we call words on this thing that we call paper. And then I use my head to read these words and then type these words onto this thing called a keyboard, into this thing we call a computer. And I did this. and people are going to see this and read these stories, this creation that I made, and they're going to engage, and every single person that reads this book is going to engage with it in a completely different way. And to think about living in somebody's head, and you have no idea who they are, where they are, how their day was when they pick up your book and they're engaging with these characters. They're going to hate a character that maybe you loved, or maybe they're going to love a character that you hate, that you created, that you meant to be a bad guy. Oh, man, it's something when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. It truly is. So what do you see yourself going with your writing and, you know, becoming you're firstly a new author. What do you want to take your writing?
I'll take it wherever the reader wants to go. You know, I don't really, I'm not special. You know, there are millions of books published every single year, and it
you
just accumulates because they're, you know. Thank you.
You know how many people come in my inbox that want to write a book but never do.
Yeah, but there are millions. Well, thank you for that. But I guess what I mean is that, you know, there are millions and millions of books, and I want to be. And I guess when you think about it, yeah, I am, because you know what? Out of all those people that hit up your inbox and say they want to write and they don't for whatever reason they don't write. They don't write the book. I'm in that elite group. Like we did it. I think just finishing and having the finished product is the win in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got a day job and it's
Me
in
too.
Real estate. And, you know, I do podcasting on the side and I write the book. You know, I don't write full time. So, you know, it's fun for me. I love this story that I hope comes out depending on. Now, as a self-published author, that means we invest in ourselves and we invest in the story, right? So the current books or the backlist books have to perform in order to fund the new project. So I'm hoping that I can break even and then I can, and if not, then I'll just hold on to it and save up and do the responsible thing and not run it up on credit. I'll publish it, next year.
It's actually cheaper if you publish your own book. I'm actually publishing my first book by myself this time. And it's a head scratcher, but it's kind of also fun because I need to know the ins and outs of publishing, how to do it.
Yeah.
And yes, I can publish my own book.
You can be your own press. So you are your own press.
Yes.
Huh.
Yes.
And then do you see yourself?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. No. You go ahead. I'm sorry.
And it's also it's a job in itself. I'm like, whoa, because you got to get it formatted, you get it edited, and you got to get the ISBN. But at the end of the day, you're actually saving you thousands of dollars.
Yeah, dude. Tell me about it. Yeah. Well, and yeah, and with your education on it, with all that you're learning, you would, hypothetically speaking, I don't know how old you are, but in 10, 20 years, you'd be, you know, you'd have so much of this knowledge accumulated that you could be in your late 40s, 50s, 60s and have authors under your umbrella. So you are your own press, and then you've got clients and authors that you could showcase that you're going to teach them or that you do it for them. You know?
Definitely. Like, let me see, who's one of the biggest authors out now? He barely ever writes a book. Everybody, he just puts his name on the book, and everybody else just writes under him.
Mm, yeah.
It ain't John Gibbons. It's another. He's the one that wrote the Alex Brown series. What's his name? Patterson. James Patterson.
Yeah, James Patterson.
He rarely ever writes a book now. Everybody who writes a book. Yeah.
So is that how he comes out with all these titles in a year? Is because he's got,
yeah.
I guess it's almost like a McDonald's franchise.
Basically, yeah.
So he leases the name out, and so it's James Patterson
mm-hmm.
with whoever.
Yep.
Huh. And that's how they get all the titles out. Because I've always wondered, I'm like, dude, I would love to be able to write that many books. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That would be like that. I would love to just write two in a year, and I've not been able to do that yet. Like two manuscripts.
Yeah. But I'm telling you,
2 years would be beautiful.
Yes, me too. Because you gotta have the passion for it. You gotta have a good story, and you have to live. For me, it's living through a story to tell
mm-hmm.
a story. My imagination will only wonder if I've lived through the story.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
for them to write, like some people can write 6 or 7 books a year. I'm like, really? How do you get a story like that? What are you coming up with? How do you get these ideas?
Well, and I think if you're gonna have that kind of output, I would like to think that you have some kind of outline,
right?
I mean, you got to have a plan. You got to go in there with some kind of plan.
Man, I'm telling you, I'm like, and they write everything. They're like, oh, I'm on my fifth book, dude. It ain't even fifth month. What are you doing? Oh, I'm just throwing out.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they've got to be outliners, man, because if you're now, I don't know if you all are outliners or if you are what they call pantsers, where you fly by the seat of your pants. I'm a pantser. This third novel, I am kind of like a mix of it, but then I ended up, like, I thought I had it plotted out, but then I started writing, and I just let the characters take me wherever they wanted to take me. And at one point, one of the characters, one of the secondary characters did something that I'm like, I can't believe you did this, woman. I can't believe you did this to him, but I love it. Okay, we'll go with it. And that's when you know you're in the zone. Is when you – and there's some people who are like, oh, my characters don't tell me to do anything. It's like, no. If you're really in the zone, if you're an actual storyteller and you, I just feel like, and I've talked to enough authors where they'll tell me something similar to that. So I interviewed last year a romance author who was telling me that she wanted the love interest and the woman to just hurry up and get it on. And it wasn't until like, more than 2/3 of the way of the book into the book that they finally, she's like, come on guys, just hurry up already. And she goes, and then finally 2/3 of the way of the book, they finally hooked up and they finally got together. And it's like, golly, what happened? What took so long? So I guess it's just your characters and seeing how the plot unfolds and getting into that zone. And I just wonder what it would be like if you're able to write full time. And maybe that's how, I don't know if, the people that you're talking to that are, it's in the fifth month of the year and they've got their fifth novel out, how they're doing it. Are they working part-time or are they writing full-time? Because it seems to me like it would be easier if you're writing full-time to crank out that kind of number.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I see. If I was writing full-time, I would never make the deadline because I'm like, look, I don't have no books in me, dude.
Well,
hey, creative energy is a thing.
Well, I've tried full-time before, full-time meaning like, you know, you're not us. Well, even now, like I work from home, so, you know, I try to, but I didn't, you know, it's hard to produce like a full book. It's hard for me to, you know, release the way I see other authors releasing like 2-3 books a month. That's hard.
Yeah.
Even working full time. I mean, even writing full time.
But you know what's so funny? Like, I actually like
working my full-time job. Like, if I stayed at home all day working, I would go nuts.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I guess it's discipline. It's all about discipline, because I've seen it's one particular author. She was given like a small little, you know, seminar on live Facebook, you know, like, you know, her writing process and how she says she's finished a book within a week. She's finished most of her books in a week. Well, you know what, Evan? You know, I guess she has a real good editor, or maybe, I know she's an excellent writer, but she must have an even more excellent editor, because her books, like, zero to none ever. Like, I think literally every once in a while I'll find one error, but majority of her books don't have no errors. And she says she finishes majority of her novels within a week, and then she showed step by step how she does it, how she disciplined herself from like 8 a.m. until 12:30 p.m. She shuts off all the TVs, radios, shuts off phone, everything, and boom, she's typing literally 2,000 words, you know, per, I think she said per hour. Like, I think it's 2,500 words per matter. She's just, like, typing, just writing from 8 to 12, then she takes a lunch break, you know, for about an hour, as if she's, like, in an actual job. She said she trained herself as if she's her writing is an actual job. So from 8 to 12, 12:30, she's, like, typing nonstop, you know, and then she takes a lunch break for an hour, then she's back at it again until 5 p.m., just writing, boom. Then every once, and then she said if she's doing anything past 5, she considers it. You know, that's how she trained herself, and that's how she finishes a full book. And her books are long, too. We're not talking about short books here, and she finishes them in 1 week. And she's an excellent writer, you know. And then her books, you know, barely any errors, if ever any at all. So
I'm curious as to whether or not she's an outliner, and how I guess you say no errors. When you read the story, do you feel as though there are any plot holes, or maybe you wish that you heard what happened to a certain character?
I mean, I haven't. Well, I haven't. I think I've read maybe 4 of her novels. She has quite a huge catalog, actually. She's a romance novel. She's a publisher. She's also a publisher, and she's an author, and she specializes in romance. And her publishing company, she only publishes romance books. You know, she's a romance author, and she only publishes romance genre. All her authors, you know, releases romance only. And when I say no errors, meaning I don't see no misspelled words, you know, no bad grammar, no inconsistency in the details. She just writes beautiful, she's really contemporary, just beautiful love stories. And there's no spelling errors, no grammar errors.
Yeah.
You know. And that's usually most of the errors you'll see. Just for, you know, you would think somebody who's writing, I just can't, you know. And then I tried it. I try, and it takes a lot of discipline. I try that discipline from 8 to 12, shut everything off. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. That creative energy is something. I mean, yeah, I think it's like a muscle, and sure, you have to just you have to use it. And the more you use it, the easier it's going to get. So it's literally like lifting weights. So you start off doing those preacher curls with a 15-pound dumbbell, and then you eventually work up to 20 pounds and 30 pounds. And before you know it, you're doing, you know, welcome to the gun show. I'm doing preacher curls with a 50-pound kettlebell, baby.
Right.
You know?
I'm a very weird person. One of my weird traits is when I'm in the house, TV has to be on, even if I'm not watching it. Like, it has to be on. Like, sitting in the house dead silent when I'm by myself and dead silent, no TV on, complete quiet, drives me crazy.
Yeah.
And I guess because I have kids, it's weird to me when there is no noise. You know, so it's like I've become kind of immune to it. Like, you know, it's strange to me when there's complete silence. You know, and I think it's something when you have kids. I think I need to do like a documentary, interview some mothers. Like, am I the only one who feel that way? That we're just so used to noise, arguing, bickering, this and that. And when you're finally alone, you know, quiet, peace, you're supposed to embrace it, right? It's supposed to be like a breath of fresh air. It's strange to me.
I've heard from several authors. I've heard several interviews with authors that love to go to cafes because they need some ambient noise. And that's almost like, it seems like that's what you like that's what you need. You're not paying attention to the TV. Mm-hmm. You just need something that doesn't keep the quiet, that doesn't keep your home quiet.
Right.
Like,
yeah. Well, I've sat at Starbucks in tight and Dunkin' Donuts in tight. I'm not going to say, well, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, they're pretty quiet. Well, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, even though they got, like, chairs, like Starbucks chairs and stuff, people are really coming in and out. They're not really sitting in there like that, you know.
Right.
So you're not really hearing any type of ambiance. It's still pretty much quietness, you know. I think Barnes & Noble have, like, you know, relaxation sections where they have like a couch and stuff. But I've never typed. I've never sat and wrote in Barnes & Noble, but they have sections, you know, lounging sections for you to write. Now, Barnes & Noble, I think I could, you know, because you got people coming in and you hear, you know, a little bit. It's not like loud noise, you know. It's sort of, Barnes & Noble is sort of like a library, you know, that you pretty much have to be quiet, but people are still talking. You know, but you could talk, you know, but in a low tone. In a library, they act like they don't want you to talk at all, you know. And then when you finally do say something, you feel like you need to whisper, you know. But Barnes & Noble is different, but they do have like a, you know, area. You know, some authors have gone to write at Barnes & Noble, but you know, you hear people talking and stuff like that. So I think that's what I need. I can't write. I don't work too well with, you know, just complete quietness. It drives me crazy. I find myself not being able to focus on what I'm writing. It's weird.
What about you, man?
Man.
You like to write in the silence, or you like like a little ambient noise, or you like hodgepodge?
I like silence.
I don't
like all the outside distractions, music, no nothing, because I'm really focused on how I'm going to put this on paper, how I'm going to get these characters to interact, and it's just for the next 2 weeks I'm dead locked on the story that I want to write.
Right.
But like me, but see, I've already brainstormed the story for about 2 or 3 months. It's just for me to put it on paper. So when I decide to put it on paper, I'm already know where I'm going with the story.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear everybody's experience with creating.
Yeah, you know, and we all write differently, and that's what makes it amazing about being an author. You know, the different styles and different ways that we figure out how to be creative. It's truly a talent.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, you have authors who, you know, authors of a genre, and it's the same genre, but they'll be on one end of the spectrum from the other when it comes to writing process. You'll have someone who is outlining for, you know, their outline is 2,500 words. It's so neatly organized, and they've got the character arcs already planned. And then you've got someone who is in the same genre that is flying by the seat of their pants. And in a well-crafted story, you wouldn't be able to tell who was the plotter and who was the panther.
Mm-hmm. True. Yes. And we just let them. So, with your book coming out, can you give us the platforms, how we can get your books, your social media sites, so fans and the audience can link up with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. Go to The Freddie Cruz. So The Freddie with a Y, Cruz, C-R-U-Z. So TheFreddieCruz.com is where to go. You can link up and get the two books. I'm on Twitter at Radio Freddie Cruz and on Instagram at The Freddie Cruz.
Awesome, awesome. Especially, I'm going to also share your books on my Author's Lounge page, which is on Facebook as well. So,
very nice. Thank you for that.
No problem. No problem. So we can get more readers out there. Well, you see what they try to do in Texas, take all the library books out of the library, which, you know, is crazy.
That's
Texas,
crazy.
I'm trying to figure out what Texas, so I think they're a little too close to Mexico. You know what I mean? I don't know what's going on down there, you know.
It's like we're in our own world,
Texas and Florida.
They'll never burn. Let me tell you something. They'll never burn all the books. I can tell you that.
Right.
Too many.
It is crazy. Texas and Florida. That's our home state. They just do what they want.
Yeah. Hey, well, you know what? We were our own country at one point in time. I don't know if they make y'all learn your own state's history, but we had Texas history, and
Oh yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, we are the only state in the union where we can fly our flag at the same level as the United States flag.
Wow.
I heard that somewhere, and I'm not sure if that's true. So. A listener will have to verify that.
It doesn't surprise me. Wow. I didn't know that one either. But I want to thank you, Mr. Cruz, for coming on the show tonight, man. It was an enjoyment talking to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for the invite to the show. I really appreciate you all taking the time to talk about storytelling and my books. And it's been a pleasure. I can geek out over storytelling and creating characters and plots and all that stuff. I could talk about it all night. But, my voice is going out, and I'm sure y'all got a show to tend to. And I'm really grateful for you all inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Mr. Freddie Cruz, everybody, Who Counseled the DJ? Make sure you get that book. It is available now. And my co-host, do you have anything?
No, I just want to, say thank you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us tonight. Did you shout out all your social media, like everywhere that they could get in contact with you and click your book?
I did, and thank you for that.
All righty.
Great. I also want to shout out my special Ethiopian friend. She has a poetry book out. It's called Looking Above. Her name is Meklit Gwelshaw. You can look it up on Amazon. She has a book called Looking Above, and she's from Ethiopia, and she does... she's just a wonderful person to talk to. She will be on the show in the next, I think, by the end of this month, February the 22nd, she will be on the Author's Lounge. And that's going to be an inspiring story in its own. So make sure you check that out. Also, February the 15th, we will not be premiering next week because we're going to be preparing for the big Valentine's bash where the authors and
poets
for my book release, The Invisible Women, and we're going to have a party like none other. It's going to be awesome. So if anybody want to contribute, any poets, any authors want to come through and sling some of that
romantic slang over Drip the Mic and Make That Mic Drip, you can call in 646-378-0355. Press 1 and give your shout-outs on that special night. It's going to be amazing.
I think we have, like, quite a few lineups for that night.
Yes, it's going to be fire.
Okay, so we have your book release on the 14th.
Yes.
And
God
so
willing. I'm pushing.
The Invisible Woman. So I have a couple, you know, releases myself. I have a book dropping on Valentine's Day as well, and then a book dropping next week still.
Yes, it's going to be a powerful show. It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, I always love to talk about Liz. So we're going to have, so how many poets we're going to have on there?
I think 5 poets.
Okay. Yeah, because you know, we had, I had a collab partner, DeCorey. He writes poetry too.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't come on the show and read out, but I could have read one of his poems. I have another author. He writes excellent poetry. I could try to get one.
Yeah, bring them all. We want a full house.
Well, that full author as well, he's also unavailable to come in and pop, but I could get his poems along with possibly the Corey's and get one poem each and read it.
And, you know,
but they write beautiful.
And like for me, even though it's my book release, I still want to give other authors and poets a chance to promote that self. I don't like taking all the shine. I just like for other authors, because we all can make it. You know, we in this together. It's no, oh, you this and you that. No, we're all as one. It's bridging the gap, you know, and that's putting each other's work out there, and that's supporting each other, and that's what it's all about. Coming together, being as one instead of, oh, we got to really do this. I got to be better than you. No, let's do it as one. Let's learn how to work together.
Right. Well, looking forward to that. That sounds like a fun feel. So,
definitely.
Can't wait.
I know, because I've been these past, oh my goodness, since the beginning of the year, I've been so busy. And then with the show, and then I'm like, oh my goodness, how can I fit everything? Like tonight, I was just editing and formatting all the way up to the time for the show. I'm like, man, I ain't going to catch a break. But, you know, sometimes you get what you ask for, so. It is what it is, and I love doing what I'm doing, so ain't no time to complain now.
Right.
You know, but I want to
thank
you. Go ahead.
Right. No, I was going to say, you know, hard work always pays off, so.
Yeah, it does. Mm. I have a little surprise for the Author's Lounge coming up in a few weeks, too, but I ain't going to reveal it yet. We'll see once the once everything comes out. I'll reveal it. I'm just gonna keep it under wraps for a while. But I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight to the Author's Lounge, presented to you by Drip the Mic. I want to thank the CEO and the First Lady. I want to thank my co-hosts. Thank you all for coming to the Author's Lounge. Don't forget to call in at 646-378-0355 or www.blogtalkradio.com. Boom. And we did it. Okay.
Good night. Good night.
Happiness.
Miss me with that bullshit. You ain't really wild, you a tourist. I be blacking out with the purist. I made 100,000, I freaked it. I made 500,000, I freaked it.
And it's like that little bitch, MVP, I don't get no sleep, no, I don't like that little bitch. Bust that open, I want that ocean, yeah, that bite back, little bitch. Do it, bite back, little bitch. do like Jack, little bitch. I ain't gon' hold you. I ain't gon' pressure, never control you. I ain't gon' front you. Keep it 100, I don't know you. Boss like Top Dog, boss my life up, crossing over. Stutter stepping, got a Hall of Fame and all my poster. I been ready, my whip been ready, my bitch been ready, my click been ready, my shit's been ready, my checks been ready, my shots on full, that's Armageddon. I got pull, I hope y'all ready, my tank on full, you know unleaded. I gotta go get it, I gotta go get it, I gotta go get it, I gotta go get it. My name gon' hold up, my team gon' hold up, my name gon' hold up, my team gon' hold up, my shots gon' fire, my team gon' roll up, my nine day twice, my queen gon' roll up. I hope y'all ready, you know I'm ready, I rain all day, you know confetti. I gotta go get it, I gotta go get it, I gotta go get it, I gotta go get it.
Miss me with that bullshit, bullshit.
You're not a gang member, you a tourist.
A tourist.
I be blacking out, I be blacking out. All the 83 cutlass
for the weekend.
I got 100,000 and I freaked it.
I freaked it.
I made my 100,000 and I freaked it.
I freaked it.
I put a Rolls Royce on my wrist. Oh yeah. Fuck his baby mama trying to sneak this. I took her to my penthouse and I freaked it.
Then I freaked it.
I haven't made my mind up, should I keep it?
Should I keep it?
I got big dog status, it ain't no secret. Daddy, 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 slime on me now. Bad bitch, I'm slurping. Put me in the car. Daddy, 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 motherfucker, no. Genie, genie, man, murder everything. Bitch, I'm on the roll and I put that on the game.
Yeah. Miss me with that bullshit, bullshit. You ain't really wild, you a tourist. I made 500,000, I freaked it. I bought an 87 for the weekend. This ain't what you want, this ain't what you want. This ain't what you want, this ain't what you want.
What you want.